Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
This is Jimmy Iovine, creator and host of the Sexy Cool Lounge podcast. And I want you to continue to shine bright and radiate your vibe because you're now listening to The Road to Rediscovery with Aubrey Johnson.
Our lives are laid out on a road of bumps, turns, struggles, and more. How do we respond? How do we endure adversity for learning and growth? I'm Aubrey Johnson, and we'll explore these questions and more on The Road to Rediscovery.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Road to Rediscovery. I'm your host, Aubrey Johnson. The Road to Rediscovery is about reflecting on life lessons to learn and grow from them, and of course, pay it forward and uplift others who are struggling through dark times. Now, as you know, my colleague, my brother, Mr. Jimmy Iovine, is the creator and host of the Sexy Cool Lounge podcast. But guess what? He now has a new title. His title, added to his credentials, is now author. That's right. He's released three powerful short story ebooks surrounding love, family, and resilience. Each story resonates with you in a special way and shares a clear, unmistakable message about legacy. That's right. You heard it. Legacy. What is legacy to you? These are all available on Kindle, but I want to specially invite you to the links that are on my Facebook page at R2R Podcast. That's at R, the number 2R podcast, my Facebook page, where I will have links to these. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not a sponsor, nor am I an affiliate. Jimmy Iovine is my brother. He has a supreme talent for writing that must be recognized. So please, I encourage you to go to my Facebook page to get those links, check them out, and leave a review and show some love for Jimmy Iovine and his new endeavor as an author. All right, fantastic. Now, for my special guest, he is one of a kind, an author, public speaker, and business owner. He's here to share powerful, absolute powerful insights from his true story, chronicled in his book, Becoming Ken, One Black Man's Journey from Ivy League to prison and back again. This is a soul-bearing, vulnerable, and transparent look into what is the reality of his experience in homelessness, addiction, crime, incarceration, and a lot more. Get ready for an eye-opening conversation as we welcome Mr. Ken Miller to the show. Ken, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you here, sir.
Well, thank you, Aubrey. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a fun time. Let's do it.
No, it truly is, right? It really is. And so, as with, you know, all other times when you were a guest on previous podcasts, I'm going to ask you if you can give us the Cliff's Notes of your journey, okay? And then we're going to go on a little journey of our own and kind of unpack some of these to share some anecdote and insights that you have for the listeners.
Sure. Let's start with a foundation. Let's start where it began. In 1962, my mother was a white teenage runaway from Queens, New York, white Irish girl. And my dad was a pimp and drug dealer in New York. And I am the union of that relationship. And at birth, back in those days, they didn't have a lot of biracial children, especially good Catholic girls from Queens. And so I was put up for adoption at birth. The story is I was adopted by a white couple. They didn't realize that the tan wasn't going away. And so 3 months later, I was put back into the system and I did 6 years of foster homes. After those 6 years, I was adopted by Irene and Sam Miller and moved to upstate New York. Mm-hmm. And then at age 12, I moved to Alaska. It's important to understand that when I was 6 years old, coming out of the foster care system, I could not read. I could not write. I could not tell time. I could not even tie my shoes.
Oh, my.
And that first summer, my mother taught me how to read, my adoptive mother, Irene. And I fell in love with reading. I was precocious as a child. And by the time I was 17, I was a National Merit Scholar. I was accepted to Harvard, and I went to Dartmouth College and got my degree from that college. While in college, I was introduced to drinking, because that's what we do as freshmen.
Right.
And at least that's what I did. And within 2 months of my first drink, I was a full-blown alcoholic. Oh my. And I am an alcoholic to this day, except I'm not a practicing active alcoholic. I just celebrated 21 years clean and sober.
Congratulations.
In between that, I have a myriad of experiences. Just like you said, I'm a three-time convicted felon. I've spent years behind bars. I was homeless for 20 years. I've been to 14 treatment centers, and I've done some things and overcome some things to now I own 5 businesses. I am very successful, as you would define success financially, and or I'm successful in my relationships with others. I am a grandfather. I am a mentor. I am a friend, and I am a kind and gentle man. I became Ken Miller.
That is absolutely tremendous, Ken. And I couldn't think of a better version of Cliff Notes than what you just articulated there. I mean, you definitely took us on a journey, and we're going to kind of dissect bits and pieces of this. Okay. So I guess your gateway was the alcohol during your college years, right? You mentioned 2 months into drinking, became a full blown 2 months.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I had my first drink in October of 1980, freshman year.
Yeah.
And by December, I could not control the amount I drank once I started under the influence of a lot of alcohol, beer.
Gotcha.
I make really bad decisions for me, my loved ones, and society. Yeah. And I went to my first AA meeting the summer of 81. I was asked by my mother to go to my first meeting. And I'd only been drinking 6-7 months at that point. But she already knew I had a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So at that point, I mean, is it safe to say, I mean, even, you know, your initial entry into college that you had some sort of support system around you?
No.
No.
No. No.
Okay. So
let me picture for the listener what I was like when I went to college. It's 1980. My senior year, my father had beat me so bad that the police were called. And I hid out my last 4 months of my high school senior year. Hid out. We hid out of fear.
Oh, my goodness.
We haven't gotten into that, but 5 years later, my dad shot my mom 6 times. That was my father. He was an alcoholic.
Right, right.
Very violent. And so I was broken when I went to college. I was broken.
Yeah.
You could say I was sort of a nerd, but I'm just a normal kid. I was very, very intelligent.
Yeah.
But I was broken and I was very naive. So you gotta have a picture of this. I'm 17 years old when I go off to college, Ivy League. And I had a jean jacket that had all the heavy metal bands because I grew up in Anchorage and I grew up around heavy metal music.
Yeah.
So I had all these heavy metal bands. I had a Jerry Curl, which I didn't know had gone out of style like 2 years before in the East Coast because I'm in New Hampshire. Okay.
Right, right.
I had not been around a lot of African Americans or Black people, so they didn't know what to do with me. Right. White folks didn't really know what to do with me. Mm. I didn't know if I was a virgin, so I didn't know what to do with girls.
Right, right.
Like I said, I didn't have a driver's license. I was odd man out. So when I started drinking, that allowed me to put some of the masks down.
Yeah.
That allowed me not to feel the profound fear that I went there with. It also allowed me to be comfortable with my capability.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Academically, because I didn't come from a prep school. I went to a public school in Anchorage, Alaska.
Yeah.
Now I was smart, but I got kids going there who went to Exeter and Phillips and Andover and Miss Porter's school. They're coming from the prep world and they're trained to be able to understand and to do work at an Ivy League level.
Yeah, they're groomed.
So I struggled. Yeah, I struggled in the sciences.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
my struggle. And then you add the alcohol and the drugs. That sure. didn't help either. But I didn't know who I was.
Right.
I really didn't know who I was. I had no clue. And so, I had a lot of depression. I was very depressed too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I didn't understand. I just didn't understand why I had so much violence as a child. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand why I was treated the way I was treated. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really understand these new groups. I had never seen a prep, so I had a lot of difficulty with preppy kids.
Yeah.
Because I thought they had it made. I didn't know that they just have the same problems just because they wear khakis and topsiders and Fair Isle sweaters and polo shirts doesn't mean they don't have problems. They just look like it to me that they had it all. Oh, everything was fine.
Yeah. Yeah, like they had it all figured out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
See looks- with their parents. No, my parents never visited. My mom didn't come until my senior graduation. But
yeah,
you know, they would come up there, you know, parent weekends and homecoming, and they'd all be dressed the same way with these golf pants on. And
sure.
I really, really struggled with that. I'm just this heavy metal liking biracial kid from Anchorage, Alaska.
Right.
A fish out of water. So I joined a gang.
Yep.
In college.
Yeah.
Most people call them fraternities, but it's a gang. And so I joined my gang so I could have some affinity for individuals that would co-sign on my behavior, which was drugs and alcohol and chasing women. That was my behavior. So anyway, that was my college. Yeah, I always tell people this. I graduated from Dartmouth with I majored in fraternity. And I minored in drinking. That's what my college years were. I'm not proud of that. I wasted a good 4 years, but I still got the degree.
Yeah. Right back there. I'll right.
put it back here. So
yeah. yeah. But, you know, there's an amount of levity that I heard in your voice.
Oh, yeah.
And the meaning by the very words of what you majored in and what you minored in that kind of really ties it all up with a bow of what you've experienced in your college years. And one thing you mentioned, Ken, that really resonated with me just a couple minutes ago was a fish out of water. And if you don't mind my saying, from what I'm hearing in your story, you were a fish out of water on multiple levels. I mean, from a racial perspective, you know, being biracial, which, you know, weren't many biracial children around that time, you know, so racially, maybe a fish out of water, geographically coming from Anchorage, you know, and I guess from a socioeconomic type of demographically, right? You know, not being, I mean, there's the preppies. And then there's the metalheads and, you know, so
yeah, athletes, all those. Yeah.
And
different groups.
And the athletes. Right. And so connecting with the group that you most identify with or closest identify with gave you, like you said, to where someone can co-sign with you or co-sign you on what you do because they do it too. And so I wanted to ask you about the importance or priority. I know hindsight's always 2020, okay, but I wanted to understand, and for the listeners, for them to understand, at the time you were going through this, what, how did you prioritize, or did you prioritize expectations? Okay, we have expectations we have of ourselves and who we want to be, what we want to be, and then expectations that others have of us, you know, and some of us may kind of lean towards doing everything possible to meet the expectations of others, you know, and then other people just say, well, screw them. I'm going to meet my own expectations. Where was your priority when it came to expectations at that time?
It was all about me.
All about
100%, yeah. About me. My mom had expectations. Mm-hmm. My mom had saved a lot of money to send me to Dartmouth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
My mom had invested a lot of time and energy. She taught me how to read.
Yeah.
Taught me how to read. Mm. Little 3x5 cards called index cards. And she wrote on it PH, TH. And I learned phonetically how to read. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
She taught me how to tell time. She taught me how to tie my shoes. So this woman had unconditional, tremendous amount of love for me and wanted the best for me because she had picked me when I was adopted. Yeah. They were adopting another child. My mother and father were adopting another Black child in New York, 1967, at the Wyndham Agency, oldest adoption agency in the United States, founded in the 1800s.
Yeah, yeah.
$1,800 in 1967. You know how much money that is? And that's so sad.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we had a 5-bedroom home we lived in upstate New York, cost $25,000. Well, they just spent $1,800 trying to adopt a foster Black mixed child.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but this is the great, they're doing the paperwork to adopt this other boy.
Yeah.
And they have this mug book. Literally, she said it was like a mug book. It was 6 inches thick, and it just had pictures and pictures of children, and, you know, male and female.
Yeah, yeah.
And she said she was just leaving through it. They were doing the paperwork on this other child. And she said she saw me, Kenneth. She's, this is how my mom talked. Kenneth, I saw you, and I said, stop the press. Stop what you're doing. I want this one. I want this one.
Is that right?
True story. I don't, wow. Anything that I'm going to express to you is truth as best of my interpretation and memory can make it, but it's truth.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So we go to college. I'm a mess. And my mother had expectations. Counselors had expectations. People saw in me my strengths.
Yeah.
You understand? I was unusual. I was like, literally, I was like the top student in the state for, you know, Black student. It was me and LaTanya Lee.
Yeah. She
went to Harvard. I went to Dartmouth.
Yeah.
Okay. She became a doctor and she's in Cali. I was everybody, but you got to understand what I had going for me.
Right.
I'm 6'2".
Yeah.
I used to model. I was a good-looking, 6'2", articulate Black male who played sports and was academically, did well. Yeah. I had everything. I looked good. I smelled good. I talked good.
Yeah.
But inside, I'm broken because I'm coming off of so much trauma. And also, you got to understand, my core issue has always been abandonment. It's not the beatings. It's me from 0 to 6, knowing I did not have a mother. I knew that at age 4,
that I
was not wanted. And so my core issue is that I was going to die alone, that I will be rejected and abandoned. So I picked up all these defense mechanisms as a child, to protect me physically and also emotionally. And then I just played them out for the next 40 years.
Wow. So a lot of coping mechanisms, for sure. And thank you for sharing with me that core root cause, right? The core, the nucleus of where all this is stemming from. Abandonment. So, you know, I was gonna come back to the question I asked you earlier of a support system. It sounds like to some degree your mother, who picked you, who chose you, and you know, paid and encouraged for you to go to college, and also urged you to go to AA. You know, was, I guess, closest to the support system.
Oh yeah, and she was great
that you had.
Let me just, and I hear what you're saying, Aubrey, but I want to explain this part of it.
Okay.
The support system is there.
Okay.
Whether I utilize it or engage with it is another question.
Right. Right.
It was always there. It's been there my whole life.
I see.
Predominantly my mother. Predominantly. Yeah. But I've had friends who had concerns, especially when I went, you know, onto the streets.
Sure, sure.
I have other family members that had concerns. But my thing was, is that I would reject them. And usually it came down to the rejection. It wasn't I was rejecting them. I was rejecting that I wasn't deserving of help. That came later, though, as I dive deeper into my self-hatred.
And it all stemmed from abandonment.
That's my core issue.
Yeah,
let me put it this way. The abandonment is a core issue.
Yeah.
But I didn't drink and drug, if I wasn't a drug addict and alcoholic, I wouldn't have had one-tenth the problems I had.
Sure, sure.
I still would have had scripts, and I would have still had defense mechanism. I still would have had coping mechanism.
Right.
But they're not that bad. You know, I still would have married and had kids and da-da-da-da-da. But the drugs and alcohol... Yeah, and I don't know how much you understand about addiction, but the thing about addiction and what addiction is I'm addicted to leaving reality. The drug is a vehicle. That's why all drugs are the same to me. Alcohol, crack cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin. I've done all of them.
Yeah,
I've done any drug. You put a drug. There were times where people say, hey, I got some drugs. And I'm like, give them to me. I don't care what they are. I don't care. I used to burglarize houses.
Yeah.
The first thing a drug addict burglar does is go to the bathroom because I'm going to the drugs.
Medicine cabinet. Yeah.
I have shot up, crushed, cooked, and shot up stuff. I don't even know to this day what it was. I have no clue what it was.
Yeah.
Because I'm addicted to leaving reality.
Yeah.
I so hate my sober or sane truth.
Right.
That I have to change my perception of reality by chemical means. Hmm. That's a sad place to be. Yeah. And then, of course, the drug you can get addicted to that you have to have for physiological reasons because you're going through withdrawals.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's incredibly damaging, and school is about this, Ken.
Okay. Sure.
One of the things I've had friends who were addicts and admitted themselves into inpatient rehab, and so from what I understand and what I hear, you know, one of the initial steps in the process is a detox. And, you know, they say, well, you know, anyone can do the detox. You know, it's the after effects, like withdrawals and the mental capacity and discipline and all the other things that has to follow. That's more of the challenge when it comes to a mind shift, a change in mindset, maybe change those who are around you, maybe change your environment. You know, just all of these different types of things that are more of a struggle after the detox. Detox is just the physiological part of removing and you go through the withdrawals. But then comes the mindset, the discipline, and then your environment. I mean, is that accurate, or are there some other elements that we may be missing in that process?
No. What you do is for every addict, every alcoholic, there's a period where the body is cleansing itself because the body goes into a cleansing mode.
Yeah.
For some drugs, you have to have medical attention while you're doing the detox because the body has to have a specific amount of this drug in the system and it has to be weaned down. Okay, cool. Right. Got right. that. I've uh-huh. been in detox 2-3 times and literally the detox part. Okay.
Yeah.
I've also OD'd, so I know what that's like. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
But once you get the, let's say you get to a point where physiologically you're not going to die mm-hmm. from not having the chemical in your system, or you've gotten down to such a small amount that now wow. you can now work on, because there's really only 3 things you got to work on. You got to work on the mental, the emotional, and the spiritual.
Gotcha. And
partly you can work on the physical, but a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
So yeah. those are all the things I worked on when I went to prison the last time. I went into prison. I told myself I had to work on 4 things.
Yeah.
Physical, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual. And I worked on all of those, and I worked on them well enough that I haven't picked up since in 21 years. But I still had a lot more growth to do, especially in the emotional area. Physically, no. Best shape I've ever been in my life.
Yeah, yeah.
My last month in the penitentiary, period. Mm. Never been stronger.
Yeah.
I competed in powerlifting. Did very well.
Wonderful.
Intellectually, probably 80% of what I'm at now. I've just read in the last, I got out in 07, so I'm 18 years. I've read a lot more books. Yeah. I just finished my 1,000th book last year since 2004.
Okay. Man,
my amazing. Record is 160 books in 1 year.
Okay. 160 books, 1 year.
Yeah. I'm in prison. What else am I going to do?
Yeah. Yeah. No.
I needed to work good on point. The intellectual.
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
good point. Because I haven't read, I'll do 30 this. So I track every book I read. Mm-hmm. I have it in a spreadsheet. I'm going to do about 30 this year. And I read 95% nonfiction. Okay, great. So I got the intellectual. The key, but this is so important. Man, so important. You can work on your emotional, your physical, your intellectual to your heart's desire.
Right.
But you still can't pick up in between. Mm. And this is why I want you to hear this. There are many people who have a drug or alcohol problem that think once I fix the emotions or the memories that were antecedent to my using, then I can use successfully. So if I deal with the rape when I was 13, if I deal with my father leaving the family when I was 8, if I deal with being assaulted at age 21, if I deal with all those things, then, and I'm good with it and I don't have the emotional baggage of those, then I can drink again. I can drink like a normal person.
Mm.
You can't. If you're an alcoholic like me, you can't.
Right.
I did not become an alcoholic because my dad beat me. I did not become an alcoholic because I was given up for adoption at birth. I did not become an alcoholic because I did foster homes for 6 years. That's not why I'm an alcoholic.
Right, right.
I'm an alcoholic because physiologically I don't have that switch that turns off any mind-altering chemical. Because what happens is after 2 drinks, I say, F it.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I say.
Yep.
F it.
Yep.
Till the wheels fall off.
Till the wheels fall off.
That is me. And I'm like many other alcoholics and drug addicts.
Yeah.
But this is, again, many alcoholics and drug addicts think if I fix these things, if I fix this past things, if I fix the marriage, if I fix the finance, if I fix, then I can have a beer on the weekends. If you're an alcoholic like me, you can't.
No.
You just can't because it just triggers.
Yeah. And that had to have been... a game-changing point of realization that you encountered. Now, when did that hit you, Ken?
It didn't hit me until this last cleanup.
Gotcha.
Because I had worked on fixing things.
Sure, sure.
Then again, I had a lot of things to fix.
Right.
I had a lot of shame-based behavior. I had a lot of things where I'd hurt people.
Yeah.
I've had three women try to kill themselves because of me.
Oh, my God.
I've tried to kill people on three occasions.
Yeah.
I've had people try to kill me on three. Three is like my magic number. Three occasions.
Wow. Man.
I've been raped. I was raped by another man. 18 years old. Raped by another man.
Oh, my
God. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
I pimped 14-year-old girls up and down Seattle. Okay? I've done armed robberies.
Yeah.
I did a kidnapping. I've gone to kill people, like I said, on three occasions. I was not a nice person under the influence or in that life.
Right.
So I got all this guilt. I have all this shame.
And I tell you what.
Things.
Yeah.
Let me just finish this. So I have all this shame. And until I dealt with that shame and I dealt with the secrets that I carried, I was doomed. You see, I'm talking about it now. I'm a black man talking about being raped.
Yeah.
I'm a black man. I was a male prostitute for 15 years on the streets. I sold myself to other men. I had one woman who was going to give me, but it didn't happen. I was like, it could be a gigolo now.
Right.
And you see, I have levity. Like you said, I love that, that you said that. I laugh at it now. I've taken away the power of you judging me.
100%.
And I feel less than.
Yeah.
I'm cool with Ken Miller. My wife loves me. My grandkids love me.
Man.
You know how powerful that is?
That's incredibly powerful, man. Incredible.
I'm well. I am well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm healed. Go ahead.
No, you are. No, absolutely. No, you are. And thank you for sharing that. I mean, that draws a vision to the mind's eye of just the fight that you have been going through, from assault to rape to pimping and being on the other side.
Yeah, okay? Prostituting.
Prostituting, you know, and removing the power from others to judge you, from judging you. I think a big source of that is your amount of transparency, your amount of realizing that there's power in vulnerability when you tell your story, you know, and full
and it helps others.
Would you say it's unapologetic? I mean, you know, not apologizing for what you've gone through. And sure, it, you know, these are things we're not, you know, proud of if we look back, but can you say it's unapologetic because you now have the power to be transparent and share that story?
My most profound word is one word, and that is truth.
There we go.
Such a sublime, profound relationship with truth. And until I could speak to truth, I was doomed. I've tried to kill myself on three occasions.
Oh my gosh. Number three, once again.
That's burned. That's six cigarettes.
Burn marks.
I burned myself. I have slash marks from razors.
Yeah.
I have ice pick because I used to jab myself with ice. It's self-harm.
Yeah.
And then my favorite thing was punching out windows. Punching out windows.
Oh man.
And so, but again, this is who I was. This is and I use the word profound, but this is the level of my pain.
Yeah.
My emotional pain. Remember, I wanted to kill myself, not because I wanted to die.
Right.
I didn't have another solution for the pain to stop. That's the only thing I can think of for the pain to stop. I don't want to die.
No.
But I can't.
There's no other way.
Because I wake up to pain.
Yeah.
Emotional pain, self-hatred, shame. I am less than. I am a piece of shit. That's what I would say to myself. And I apologize if that's against your thing.
No.
That's the way I would talk to myself.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's I am. I'm cool with guilt. I did my truth.
Yeah, yeah.
When I stuck up that the 7-Eleven, I stuck up with the gun. I did that. And that individual was afraid.
Yeah. Another human being.
Yes, another human being.
Yeah.
I mean, the things I did to these, I was pimping 14-year-old girls on the streets. That's who I was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm taking advantage of them because I have the gift of gab and I can be a nice guy.
Yeah. But it takes one who was taken advantage of to take advantage of others.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it happens to you, you can impose on others over time.
I would do anything for crack.
I got you.
Anything.
I got you.
If someone asked me to kill someone, and I thought I could get away with it, because if I don't get away with it, I can't smoke the crack.
Right.
If I don't get away with it.
Yeah.
I'd have done it. I remember one guy came to the motel. So the street world is like this. You're on the streets, and what you predominantly do is live in motels. You just go from one motel to another. And there's a whole substrata of people. You have dealers, you have hustlers, you have runners, you have prostitutes, you have alcoholics who are just alcoholics.
Sure.
But anyway, you have all these different levels, and I could go into that for next hour. But in that world, what you're trying to do, of course, is survive. And what you're trying to do is feed your addiction.
Yeah.
So I was in the motel room and a guy comes in and he looked at me and he knew me. He said, Ken, you down? Yeah. Let's do it. Yeah. I didn't know what it was.
Right.
But it was we call a lick.
Yeah.
And so we did a robbery.
There you go. You down for whatever.
Yeah, I was down for whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm good. I need my fix.
Yeah.
I need to leave reality.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And another thing you mentioned earlier, Ken, is that you didn't want to die, but there was no other way that
I had no other way
that you could remove the pain. I mean,
right.
You know, the drugs and the fix is a temporary, it's a Band-Aid, but you were looking for a permanent way to just remove the pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
I understand. I understand.
And then, and I did remove it.
Yeah.
Counseling.
Reading,
and spiritual. There's a spiritual, I haven't even really talked about it, but it's a spiritual aspect.
And that's the harder way out when you really think about it.
What is
the way out for permanently removing the pain?
Yeah.
Okay. There's the easy way out, which is the unmentionable in my mind. Yeah. Okay. The harder way is the journey you took to come back, you know? And so I want to ask you this, you discovered a relationship with truth and became intimate with your truth, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. That's your North Star. So,
right.
I want to ask you about a couple things that you can share insight when it comes to gratitude. Okay. And then if you don't mind, I'd love for us to touch on shame and guilt, forgiveness, and then let's talk about some good stuff that you're doing and affecting the lives of others in a positive way.
Let's do it.
Right? All right. So I don't want to give away your book. Your book is very open, very transparent. There's some, I don't want to say rawness to it, but there's some, you know, in your face type stuff that is quite frank, you know? And so, and that really, I mean, you got to get straight to that point to draw the image in the mind's eye. So in your book's introduction, Ken, you express gratitude for the Reno police officers who pinned you to the asphalt, right? You know, among friends, counselors, and sponsors and everything, but you also thanked your enemies. Can you break down for the listeners why you carry gratitude for those who participated in the unfortunate events, you know, as well as the fortunate ones, which is quite obvious why you thank them?
I'm the sum total of all my experience. Yes. And good, bad, and indifferent.
Yes.
those individuals. So one of the things in recovery, rediscovery, rebirth, is the ability to forgive.
Yes.
And what I'm forgiving is you. It's not so much I'm forgiving the act, right, but I'm forgiving you. My dad shot my mom 6 times. I forgave him before he passed away. We sat down and talked.
You did.
And I forgave him. But before that, I wanted to kill him.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very close to my mom. I mean, it was the closest. I love my mom. So,
yeah.
But I've had other people. I've had my jaw broken twice, my eye orbital broken, my nose broken. I've been put into the hospital. I put people in the hospital. Yeah. That's the streets. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. They were just as broken as I was. Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
And we're all children of God.
We certainly are.
We're just one speck of 8 billion. Mm-hmm. And again, once you start understanding truth, at least for me, how I began to understand truth. First of all, there's two different truths. There's truth with a capital T and there's truth with a small t.
Right.
Capital means it's proper. It's God's truth.
Yeah.
And then there's man's truth or my truth. I can be on the 19th floor of a building, turn to the people behind me and say, hey, check this out. I just took 4 hits of acid and I can fly. Watch. And there's a thing called gravity because that's God's truth.
Right. That's God's truth.
And I can't fly.
Yeah, proves otherwise. Yeah.
So one of my things is like I do, and I have spent a lot of time trying to identify what is God's truth. Yeah. And God's truth is that we're all his children. And God's truth is we're just a small microcosm. And God's truth is that people are hurting and people are damaged and they will do things. If I can't forgive them, how can I forgive myself? Because I'm a child of God. And I had to forgive myself because I did some horrible things. Okay.
Yeah. No. And thank you for that, because that is that's a true segue into my next question. And so I want to know from you, Ken. And I guess I don't know. Now I'm thinking about it. I guess it wouldn't matter either way. But in one way or another, okay, we all bear tasks of exercising guilt or shame, maybe both guilt and shame. Is there a change in how these affect someone who experiences, let's say, the mountaintop, right, and then falls from grace, versus someone who started out in a criminal or traumatic environment and then rises to prominence?
Sure, it can be. It's up to the individual how they perceive it. Mm-hmm. For me, it was probably more difficult because I'd been there. I got out of college. I was making $50,000 a year wearing Hickory Flint, Allen Edmond wingtips.
Yeah, you're at the top.
I was at the top.
Yeah.
I had modeled. I was in Alaska Single Men's Magazine, the first issue.
Yeah.
I was on PM Magazine show. I was supposed to be on Oprah in 1986.
Yeah, yeah.
They had called and I was supposed to fly to Chicago. I mean, I had a lot going for me. So I had gotten up pretty high. And
right.
Then I came down.
Right.
And here I am, you know, walking down the street having diarrhea in my pants.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I'm an alcoholic living off of Doritos and 40-ounce natural ice beer.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's wrong with that picture?
Right.
And so now I'm angry at self and I have all that regret and all that, again, self-hatred towards self.
Yeah.
And now I'm in all these statements of I am. That's shame. Shame is a state of being. Mm-hmm. Guilt is a state of doing. That's the difference. And so what we encompass is I am a piece of shit. I am less than. I am not worthy. I am not competent. I am not beautiful. I am not a child of God.
Yeah.
That's shame. Whereas guilt is, yeah, I did it. Mm-hmm. I did it.
Yeah.
That's true.
Act of doing, right.
But it's true. I tell people I'm guilty. Mm-hmm. You look me up on CardView. Mm-hmm. I'm guilty.
Uh-huh.
So I had to change from shame to guilt. I'm cool with guilt.
Yeah.
A lot of people are not cool with guilt. Oh, I can't feel guilty about things. Yeah. Feel guilty.
Yeah.
Don't do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm guilty and I don't do it anymore.
You know, Ken, there's a sense of liberation that I sense in your voice when you say that you are cool with guilt. You claim it, you own it. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, to your point earlier, you made, you know, you take the power from someone who may be so quick to judge. Okay. They can't judge, or they can't really, break you when you actively, verbally own what, you know, what guilt you claim to own. You know, it's like, okay, well, what's left for them? Nothing, because you took that power, right? So I find that absolutely tremendous. One other thing I wanted to ask you is, overall, in this entire journey, Ken, where have you placed yourself or considered yourself when it comes to being the victim? I mean, you know, some people tend to navigate through life from the lens of being a victim. Some don't, you know, some say, look, I'm not letting this define me, who I am. Sure, it happened to me. I'm going to acknowledge that, but you know, I'm going to move on from there. And some people shift. Some people go from navigating through a life as being the victim in that lens and then realizes that maybe it doesn't serve them. And so changing that mind shift, okay, that changing that view, that perspective, maybe it causes them no longer to think that way. Where has the thought of being the victim or the role of the victim play in your life in this journey?
So one of the things I mentor men all over the country. I mentor black men all over the country. And all the guys that I've worked with, I talk to them a lot about when you tell your story, don't be the victim or the hero.
Right.
Just talk the truth. How somebody interprets is up to them. Because I've had people interpret my story as me being a hero. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm not the hero. Mm-hmm. I was the pimp.
Yeah.
I was the drug dealer.
Yeah,
I'm not
a
hero in my story. Mm-hmm. The heroes are the women that survived me or survived, or the victims that survived my interactions with them.
Yeah.
You want to make a hero. The heroes are the cops that arrested me. The heroes are the judges that locked me up. The best thing that ever happened to me is when I went to prison. 100%. The best thing that ever happened to me, is my last prison term. Gave me 3 years to work on Ken, so I was well enough to go into the civilian world and not create too much more damage.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And then the other thing about this is real important. I take away victimhood because I need to accept responsibility for my part in the action, especially as an adult.
Right. Exactly.
Because I thought I was a victim of my mother. I wasn't a victim. She did the best thing that she could. She's a 17-year-old white Irish girl in 1962.
Yeah.
She can't go around with a mixed child.
Right.
I mean,
right.
She really can't. I mean, you could say, well, she could have. No, it wasn't happening back then. She did not abort me.
No, no.
She's Catholic.
Yeah.
I am so honored. When I met and sat down with her, I thanked her. I thanked her.
Mm. Yes.
And especially then I got to hear the rest of the story. She thought I was adopted by the white couple because she met the couple.
Yeah.
Because she wanted me to grow up Catholic. That was her thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, this is a lot to my story, as you can tell. But the thing is that I wasn't a victim. Once I got the rest of the story, I even understand why my dad shot my mom. Mm, I understand his pain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I understand his pain. Yeah. And I understand why he was so angry at me growing up. Why? Because he had this beautiful woman all to himself.
Yeah.
And she wanted, he already had two kids from another marriage. My mom never had biological kids.
Right, right.
And so this is his, you know, second marriage, her second marriage, and she wanted to adopt a child. And now he had to share that love.
Right.
With me. And he's an alcoholic, and he's a self-pitying alcoholic.
Sure.
Terrible type to be. So I end up, but anyway, I understand. Does it mean I say it was all right what he did? No. But I understand his pain. And what a beautiful, because again, I went and sought truth.
Yes.
But again, being the victim means that fate, I'm a big one on this, having agency in your life.
100. 100. I write, yes.
I have a pad.
That's
every
the key.
Day, I write a list of what I'm going to do that day. Mm-hmm. But at the top, I put the day. I put what time I start. I usually start about 5 to 6 in the morning. I'm in the office. And then I put a list of the things I'm going to do that morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Above that, I put one sentence. Mm-hmm. I am responsible. That's all I put on there. There's 100 memes I could give you. There's 100 things we've talked about. But all I put on there is I am responsible. So when I look over there and I think it's the wife, I think it's the client, I think it's one of my staff members.
Yeah.
No, I am responsible for how I interpret it, how I feel, and how I act.
Yeah.
Because I just want to say one last thing on that. One of the key things that I had to learn was to move from reaction to action. Remember I said I have scripts?
Yep.
When I went to the penitentiary, if you call me a punk, a bitch, or a nigger, it was automatic I would hit you. Oh, I don't care how big you are, because those are code words on the street and in the penitentiary, which means I will take advantage of you if you don't fight me.
Right, right.
I know that.
Yeah.
And I've had people call me and we scuffle.
Sure.
But then I get out of prison and my 18-year-old nephew calls me. Were you somebody's little bee in the penitentiary?
Oh, my gosh.
And he's the first one I've never hit. I'm in shock. And I got 3 years clean and sober.
Yeah. And I can see the shock. I can see why you would be. Yeah.
So I call up. He's my half-brother. You know, my brother from my dad.
Yeah.
I call. I said, Mike Jr. said XYZ. He said, put him on the phone.
There you go.
I gave my phone to my nephew.
Yep.
He came back. Unc, my bad. My bad. I apologize. My brother told him. Because he knows.
Yeah.
My nephew didn't grow up in that environment.
No, he didn't. No.
So anyway, it's just, again, there's so much that we have to. And I don't want to cut it short, but I want to say this to the, because this is the important part.
Yeah.
I am well, Aubrey. I am well today. And what does that mean? That means that I am capable or competent to life. I've had two mothers and a wife die since I've gotten out of prison since 2010.
Yeah.
Okay. I've walked through that with grace and honor. Mm. Okay. I have dealt with financial, I've dealt with physical, but I've dealt with it. I'm competent to life.
Yeah.
I don't work on me. I don't read self-help books. I'll do a podcast here and there. I'll listen to one, but I have different things I'm listening to. I'm listening about AI and listening to, you know, different things.
Yeah, yeah.
but I'm not working on me. I am cool with Ken. And the other way I know that is because people do not reflect back to me that they have friction.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So therefore, and this is the important part, I can give out. I can mentor black men all over this
100%.
Country.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can have a black man's book study.
Yeah.
For free. Mentor for free.
Yeah.
Speak around the country for free. Because I'm not spending all my time trying to be great. Right. I'm writing a book called I'm Good with Good.
Yeah.
I don't need to be great. I don't have the capacity to be great at anything.
Yeah.
I choose not to be. I just want to be good and take that capacity because I could be great at some things. Mm-hmm. I'd rather take those hours and give them to my family. I'd rather take them and give them to my mentees, give them to my sponsees, give them to society at large.
Yeah.
I'd rather take that. I just want to make sure I got that.
No, Ken, I am so glad you got that in because, you know, that's a deep, rich, profound statement that you just said that is a true testament to your character. It's a true testament to who you are. In this conversation, Ken, you have demonstrated and given an example of several virtues. And just from this last question that I asked you, I picked up on humility. Okay. You're not trying to be the hero.
I love it.
Okay. And that's the example. That's the insight I wanted you to share with the listeners. Okay. Humility. Another piece that and another virtue that I picked up from you in explaining this is empathy. Okay. Mm-hmm. You put yourself in your mother's shoes back in 1962 and basically placed yourself in the reality of that time to in order to understand why she couldn't keep you, you know. And fast forward some years, you got to sit with her and talk with her and thank her. You know, so humility, empathy, those are tremendous virtues on top of all the other ones that you've demonstrated this evening. And you said, I am good with good as, I guess, your next book. Well,
no, my next book is on respect.
Respect.
Yeah, and disrespect, but it's on respect.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
More people, you got a sense, not you, but I want the listeners to understand this. You read the newspaper and you think that people kill or men kill other men because of money, drugs, or sex. It's not that. It's disrespect. You've disrespected my drugs. You've disrespected my woman. You've disrespected my money. And you've disrespected me because respect is one thing. I'll define it for you.
Yeah.
It is acknowledgement of a person's position or stature within a community.
Right.
So when I respect my grandmother or in the Native community, my wife's Alaska Native, they have tremendous respect for elders.
Yes.
Because they acknowledge their position within the community.
Yes.
In the Black vernacular, we have this great respect for our Black grandmothers.
We sure do. They're the matriarch.
Yeah. They're the matriarch.
Right, right.
Because we acknowledge their position within the community of the family, the church, and the Black community. Yes. Because unfortunately, Black men many times are not there. Just the facts, ma'am.
Okay? Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a hard truth. But it is the truth.
A little while. But so that's my next book is on respect and disrespect.
Okay.
And then I'm going to write a book on it's going to be something around it's good enough to be good or I'm good with good.
I got you. Yeah.
Can't wait. So I have three more books probably in the next 6 months to a year.
Well, Ken, that's very exciting, man. And one of the things that you said earlier It was a simple sentence. And mm-hmm. as soon as you said it, I thought, you know what? That could be a book title. That could be a book title. And here's what you said. You said, I am cool with Ken. Okay. Mm-hmm. And becoming Ken is becoming, mm-hmm. I don't want, you probably wouldn't call it Ken 2.0, right? I mean, where you are today versus the prominence before the fall.
You can believe it. You gotta hear this story real quick.
Okay.
So it took me 2.5 years to write the book.
Yeah.
So I started off with a ghostwriter because I hate to physically write.
Yeah.
My mind moves much quicker than I can type and or write for you.
Sure. Yeah.
But I can talk. Mm-hmm. So we sat down and she got, I believe, over like a 3 to 4 month period, we'd meet every week, 83 hours. Of me talking.
Wow.
So when they went to put the book together,
yeah,
what you read was approximately 1/4 of the stories.
Really?
Of the stories. Yeah, 1/4, 1/3. So yeah, I could, and I would like to write another book more on thematic.
Sure.
On, you got some of the stories, you know a little bit about me. I could maybe do that in one chapter, give you that cliff note version. But let's talk about some of the lessons that I have learned and how we apply them.
Yes.
Because, again, I've been teaching this for 15 years.
Wow.
On how to be resilient.
Yeah.
How to overcome problems.
Yeah.
How to... And one of my biggest things I've been working on the last year or two is how to change the emotions around past memories.
Yes. Yes.
That is probably the one I've been working on the most, working with guys on memories.
Yeah.
And the emotions connected with those memories. Because what most people do is when they have a memory, they stop at the emotion.
Right.
And they don't use the cognitive, intellectual part of the brain to try to understand. Remember, you said something I thought that was really good, really cogent. And what you said was you have the ability to empathize with those that have harmed you. If I can empathize with people that have beat me, if I can empathize with the man that raped me, if I can empathize with my father who shot my mom and beat the heck out of me, if I can empathize with the mother that put me up for adoption, that's an admirable quality, but it also takes away the hatred. It takes away the negative feelings.
Yes, it
because
does.
I haven't forgiven.
Yes, it does. Yes.
And it did. Poison.
That anger, that hatred, it's poison.
Right.
And you know what they say about poison, right? They say having resentment and poison, or having resentment towards someone else, and anger with them is like drinking poison and hoping they die. You know, it ruins you inside.
Right.
You hold on to that resentment, you know?
And we all have the other meme, cliche, hurt people hurt people.
Hurt people hurt people, 100%. Right.
And that's, and you know, and be honest with you, and I work with all my guys. I tell them, don't talk to me in cliches.
No, no.
Because cliches are an excuse for lazy thinking. 100%. Don't tell me the definition of insanity is doing the same thing, expecting different results. That is not the definition of insanity.
No.
Insanity is the inability to perceive reality.
There you
go. It means not healthy of mind. Sanus means health. It's Latin.
Right.
And it means not healthy of mind.
Yeah.
When you're insane, you cannot perceive reality. You're neurotic, you're paranoid, you're schizophrenic, you're psychotic.
Yeah.
You're perceiving things that are not there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we just have different terms for those. That's insanity.
Yeah.
Okay. That's not doing the same thing, expecting different results. That's a cliche. I'm big on thinking.
No, and encourage the men that you work with, right? The men of color, encourage those men to put effort and strength and energy into thinking and not resort to lazy ways.
Because in the end,
And the end, that's all you got.
That's all you got.
Because you can't call up your dad to ask for what I do next. You can't get a hold of your wife. You have to have the ability. Many people have difficulty thinking deeply.
Yeah.
And it's getting worse because we're doing 30-second TikTok. We're doing Facebook Shorts, Facebook Reels. And I'm not, and that's one of the reasons I love your show and what you're doing, Aubrey. We've been on an hour and 10. I can go for another 20 minutes. It doesn't matter to me. You can cut it all you want. But but at least we're going in. People are hearing stuff that would not, I haven't seen anybody else talk like me. I'll be honest with you. Right. I'm sure there are. I'm not saying I am unique.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
But I have a gift that I can express truth. And it's truth. Why would I say this stuff? It doesn't make me look any better to anyone. There are people, and I have people reflect back. I appreciate it. You pimp teenage girls. I respect that. I understand that. But that's my truth.
That's your truth.
That's my truth.
Yeah.
And I'm not proud of it. At one point, I was proud of it.
Yeah.
On the streets. That was impressive. Right. Because what it said is you had this gift of gab and the ability to talk these immature young women or girls into doing something to pay for your addiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
And other guys were jealous and envious of me and tried, you know,
to take
whatever. But that's their world. But I'm not proud of that.
No.
Anyway, I'm not proud of any of my criminal behavior. Believe me. Let's talk about that real quick. One last thing. What's the greatest sin, Aubrey?
The greatest sin?
Yeah, the paramount, the penultimate sin is the sin of
blasphemy.
I don't know if you read Paradise Lost, but it's
awesome. No, I haven't. No.
Okay. The penultimate sin is the sin of pride.
One of the seven.
Because pride says that I am a God unto thyself.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So in the story of, which is one of the great in the Western canon, Paradise Lost, Satan goes to God. Satan's an archangel. He sits on the right side of the throne.
Yeah.
And he says to God, I want to be equal to you. I want to be your equal. And God's like, you can't be my equal.
Right.
I'm God.
Right.
And he said, no, I want to be your equal. And God says, I cast thee into Hades.
Yeah.
You can be a God down there.
Right, right.
Because when you are a God unto thyself, blasphemy, coveting your neighbors, envy. Those are all because I'm a God.
Yeah.
I can make the rules.
Yeah, yeah. Entitlement.
And so,
so forth.
It's the opposite or antithesis to humility and being humble.
It truly is.
Because what I know is I am just a child of God.
Yes.
I am imperfect.
Yep.
I have made mistakes.
Yep.
I make mistakes, but my mistakes are so small these days and so literally irregular. I really don't veer much outside the line.
Yeah.
Just a nice, kind, and gentle guy today. But I used to play God. We used to have a term on the streets. I am the judge, jury, and executioner.
Yeah, I've heard.
And we would say that to people before we did something.
Oh, sure. Oh, man.
Okay? Because I'm playing God.
Yeah.
I have your fate is in my hands.
Yeah.
And don't you move.
Yeah.
Don't you move.
Not only did you say it, you felt it at the time.
I did it.
And then
I was in that position too. I got, I was under, I'd done something. Yeah. I'll just give you the quick one. I went to kill someone. No, did I go to kill him? No, I didn't go to kill him. I went to shoot him. If he died, so be it.
Right.
Over $100.
Wow.
disrespected me.
Yeah. Again, back
to this. I had a 9mm. I'm looking for them. I'm telling everybody on the streets, I'm looking for XYZ, XYZ, yep. XYZ, going yep. to all the spots.
Yep.
Can't find them. Hour or two later, I don't have the gun. I go into a motel room to buy some crack. I get in the room. The door closes behind me. And they're young drug dealers from Stockton, California. Oh, you're the one looking for XYZ.
Yeah.
Sit your butt down. They didn't use that nice of language.
Right, right.
And they had the guns on me. And wow. I remember sitting there at that table. And when he came back, he had to make a decision whether to kill me or not.
Right.
And I knew that. I knew, because I'm coming to shoot. He knows.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was one of the few times I was afraid maybe three times. I'm talking about afraid physically yeah. on the streets. Yeah. And that was one of them.
I got you. You were on the business end of I am the judge, jury, and executioner.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he was.
Yeah. And it was.
And I think the only reason he let me live, because this wasn't his, he's in Reno, Nevada. They're visiting to come sell drugs and party
yeah.
at the casinos.
Yeah.
And he knew I was from there.
Yeah.
And he didn't know who I might have told that, because I have people too.
Yeah.
Okay. We didn't play, but I don't have. I'm in a position where I am the victim at this point.
Right. Right. So, back to what we talked.
Yeah, just going back, I just
yeah
getting out of playing God. Mm-hmm. I had to get out of playing God, and start using the. You talk about one of the positive things, which is grace. And there's grace in the spiritual and the God sense, but grace in the human sense for me is right. tolerance.
Yes.
That's all it is. It's tolerance. Yes. It's space.
Yes.
Allow a person to be human.
Yes.
So if somebody comes and says something that makes you feel less than, maybe they were having a bad day. Okay, just give them the space.
Yeah.
Because somebody took 6 rocks of crack cocaine from me, stole. I went to kill that person.
Yeah.
Another one, I was trying to throw off the balcony on the 3rd floor of the Fireside in Reno, Nevada, 4th and Lake. 3rd floor, I had him halfway over the balcony because he was talking out the side of his neck. This is the Ivy Leaguer. This is the guy you're talking to.
Yeah, yeah.
And the people who are in the room, other drug dealers and hanger-ons and working girls, rushed out. Not to save him. He's this white dude acting stupid.
Yeah.
But there's a problem when there's a body lying on the ground, 3 stories up.
Yeah,
brings heat to the room, and they didn't want heat to the room because we got drugs and guns and everything else in the room. Yeah. That's why they didn't want me to throw the guy off.
Oh, sure, sure. I could see
and
that.
And again, this is levity.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know that affected him.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. I know that affected him.
Yeah.
So again, playing God. Yeah. I don't play God anymore. I'm just a child of God.
And there's the humility and the spiritual connectedness, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's truly, truly deep, Ken. So how can the listeners connect with you, learn more about your great work, and pick up a copy of this book, Becoming Kid?
So if you want to connect with me, anyone who wants to connect with me, just go to my LinkedIn. Ken Miller 84 is my handle on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook, Ken Miller 84, Ken Miller Alaska. You could probably look up. If you'd like my book, it's Becoming Ken. It's on Amazon, Audible, and Kindle.
Gotcha.
And if you want to, send me an email, it's ken@kenmillerspeaks.com.
And this
is the thing, is I will answer any email. I will personally. I've had people
come up to Seattle to sit down and talk with me because they read the book, which I thought was super cool.
Yeah.
Because I live in north of Seattle. So if you want to come up, I'll buy lunch.
And talk
about it. I'm cool.
Yeah, take a trip up to the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, get some coffee and
some rain.
Some rain, salmon, and have a nice dinner and talk about the book. Oh, man. All right. Well, Ken, we are going to make sure we have your email address, your LinkedIn handle, and any other links in the episode show notes so the listeners can click those links, connect with you, follow you, order a copy of your book, learn more about your work while listening to this conversation. Mr. Ken Miller, I can't thank you enough for coming on to the show, sir. I hope we can stay in touch and hopefully maybe bring you back in the near future after the release of your next book.
I'd love to. Anytime.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening. And hey, look, you may think this often at times, but in our daily struggles and adversities, we're never alone. And hope is always around the corner. I humbly ask that you please share this show with someone you know, someone you love, who needs motivation, inspiration, and support. And you know, when it all comes down to it, we're all just roadies on this journey of life. But it feels good having you on the road with me. Thanks again for listening. We'll chat again soon. We really hope you enjoyed this episode of The Road to Rediscovery. We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us an email at roadtorediscoverypodcast@gmail.com and leave us any questions or comments you may have.